Hello again, and welcome to another edition of Drummer Nation. This is a very special show with a very special guest. But before I get to him, let me introduce you to my partner in crime, my esteemed colleague, Adam Nussbaum. How are you today, sir?
All's good. All's good. I'm staying on this side of the grass, so that's a good thing.
Absolutely. I saw your thing with John DeChristopher the other day on a whole panel discussion with you and a bunch of other greats about the legendary Freddy Gruber. That was a great show.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, we could have gone on for hours talking about him. What a character.
I know. I was pleased to know him, and he was a friend. Now, I asked Adam for some show ideas, and he said, why don't we talk to some bass players? I said, well, that's a great idea. Why don't you bring in a really good bass player? Well, I wasn't expecting him to show up with a legend, but indeed he has. And so let me introduce to you the legendary Steve Swallow. Hello, Steve.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Oh, it's an honor to meet you, sir. I've heard most of the great jazz musicians of my lifetime, but I've never had the opportunity to hear you live, though I've been aware of your work for decades. So it's an honor to have you on the show.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Now, I know you and Adam have worked together a lot. I was listening to this record last night, Damaged in Transit. Holy smoke, man. It's a lot of people calling that a classic, a masterpiece, and it was done live, right?
Yes, it was. It was done live over a couple of days touring in France. Is that right, Adam? Do you recall the circumstances?
We were out there, and Bill Strode was, you know, the commander at the desk, and he just was recording us, you know, at different gigs.
And he caught exactly, us in flight. And we got lucky a couple of times. I'm happy with that album, too.
Yes, well, you should be. You're both being modest. But let's go back to the, you know, I don't want to do a lot of early stuff because, you know, there's a lot of the information on you out there, and I want to get into some guys talking music. But your website, for people who want to know, is it steveswallow.com?
No, it's wattextrawatt.com. That's wattextrawatt.
Okay, well, I encourage everybody to go there. There's media stuff and video and audio and bio and everything you'd want to know. And Adam, you have one. Is it adamnussbaum.com, right?
Yeah, it's kind of in a dormant stage right now because my webmaster has decided to fly the coop. And this was done way back in the day when you needed an HTML individual. So I'm going to have to shift things around. Part of me says I should, and the other part of me is like, eh. But yeah. I think I have to live in the times we're in, unfortunately.
This is the time we're in, yeah. So, Steve, you started out as an upright double bass, contrabass, stand-up bass, whatever people are calling it these days. You started out with the double bass, right?
Yes, that's true. And played it exclusively until I was 29, 30 years old, and then had the grave misfortune to fall in love with the electric instrument, and my fate was sealed.
Well, when you did that, it was a time that met with some resistance, I know. Back then, there was an argument in the jazz community about whether you could have electronic instruments. People were in passionate arguments about the Fender Rhodes. The electric bass wasn't readily accepted, isn't that correct?
That's entirely correct. In fact, if anything, you're understating it. An overwhelming majority of the jazz community was entirely opposed to electronification and contemptuous of it as well. And I fell into that camp. I know well that feeling. I was the same until the fateful day when I touched an electric instrument, and that changed everything.
That's a great story. So you just had like an epiphany. You picked up the instrument and fell in love with it.
Yeah, exactly. Many of the best things that happen in life happen that way, I think. Happen suddenly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just to steer the discussion toward my relationship with the drums and Adam in particular, perhaps, and all of that. The same is true, I think, of bass players and drummers. they're likely to fall in love at first play or not, and somehow the die is cast.
You get those great combinations, like in baseball, they call it the battery, right? The pitcher and the catcher. Well, let's talk about
Exactly.
drum.
There's an honorable tradition within jazz of bass drum combinations that have been impossible
Well,
to
you've worked with
replicate.
some of the best in the world. Let's talk about some of those. Going way, way back, you worked with Joe Jones?
I did. I did, and it was lovely. He was a commanding personality. How's that?
Nicely put.
Nicely
He
put,
had a
huh?
commanding presence. He always sat up straight and a big smile on his face, and he was regal. He was majestic.
Indeed, he was, and I was in awe of him. I wish, in retrospect, that I had been less so. I only played with him on a couple of occasions, and he was warm, supportive, and a magnificent player. I prior to playing with Papa Joe, I had spent some time playing with other drummers of his generation or near his generation, Manzi Johnson and a bunch of them, more than could be mentioned in the time we've got. So I was undeterred by any stylistic issues. He was playing as he had always played. He stuck to his guns. He didn't become a bebop drummer at the time. Many of his peers did, with maybe with Sid Catlett in the forefront in that movement among drummers. So I was playing a style I knew and that I loved. I wasn't at all. There was no issue there at all, and he was playing beautifully. At the top of his game, I thought. I don't know how he seemed old to me, but I was only in my early 20s, so I expect he was somewhere in his 60s at that time, or less. What do you think, Adam? You'd know the.
I think he was born in 1909.
Interesting. Okay, so he would have been in his
1909 or 1911 are the dates that come into my mind.
would
Hang in.
sound about right.
Yeah.
And he was hilarious, I thought too. He wasn't. He didn't mean, I felt, to be taken so to be taken seriously. He was. He was an engaging conversationalist. He wanted responses, and he wanted them quickly. He reminded me of Roy Haynes in that regard. Each of those guys had lightning fast reflexes across the board, and physically and mentally as well. And I found that really exciting and challenging to play with. Yeah,
No,
go
I
ahead.
was going to say that one of the lines I heard once that Max Roach was credited to have said was that for every three beats a drummer plays, five come from Papa Joe.
That's about right. That's about right.
My take on
Wonderful.
Joe, my take on Papa Joe is, I think he was maybe the first legato drummer. In regard to, have bringing it up from the bottom, more up under the top, and that swing and that feeling that he got that enabled things to occur. Lester Young played in the same manner. Lester Young needed somebody like Papa Joe and vice versa. They helped to work together. And I remember reading about, the bassy All-American rhythm section with Walter Page on bass and Freddie Green, and they all were giving so much up to Walter Page.
Yeah, and his name was on the tip of my tongue, and talking about great rhythm section, great bass player, drummer, hookups, that would be a serious one. And it's serious on a variety of levels, too. I mean, not only was it hugely fun to listen to Walter Page and Papa Joe play together, but it had a strong effect on the journey of the rhythm, the evolution of the rhythm section. It took it way beyond, for instance, what the Ellington rhythm section of that time had been playing. Sonny Greer had a more straight up and down approach to rhythmic demarcation. Papa Joe was a horizontal player, and Sonny Greer was a vertical player.
That's interesting.
And like comparing Frez and Coleman Hawkins.
Very much so, yeah. I'm doing so without making a value judgment too, because
of course. You moved to New York in what, like 1960, something like that?
1960.
And that's the best school in the world. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about, if you were a kid today, would you go to New York to learn to play jazz, or would you go to a college, or maybe both?
I do believe New York is still, in a way, the center of it all, and there are still young musicians foolish enough to come to the city. New York City was a much more welcoming place in 1960 than it is now. And the environment for learning to play was, I think, much more hospitable than it is today. There were endless coffee house gigs, $5 gigs in 1960, and the very best young players were working that circuit of gigs. On a good day, you could do two or three of those and make as many as $10 or $15.
Yeah, but rent was like $100, right?
That was a princely sum. My rent was $40 a month
for
an entire floor of a loft building.
You can't park for 2 hours for $40 anymore.
Exactly.
After the tolls. No, but
to swerve back to topic, I think New York is an almost impossibly difficult situation for a young aspiring player, but nevertheless there's a strong pull toward the city. But it would also seem that the schools are a much more supportive environment than they were in the past, and I wouldn't discount their importance as well.
Now, when you moved to New York, that was a time of big change in the jazz community. It was all, you know, the 60s, highly interactive, the role of the bass, the role of the drums were changing quite a bit over maybe the way you were playing with Papa Joe.
Yes, they were indeed. And that's another aspect of the marvelous intensity of New York City at that time. Not only were there a lot of really excellent young aspiring players converging on the city at exactly that time, but there was change in the air. Ornette Coleman was appearing at the Five Spots. Cecil Taylor was drawing attention. There was a real focus within the young musician community on change, on evolving the role of the rhythm section.
Now, don't you think that may have helped with the acceptance, ultimately, of the electric bass, that everything else was changing so much, too?
Maybe so. You know, I hadn't given that much thought. And of course, by the time I came to the electric bass, 10 years had passed since I'd arrived in New York City. But I wouldn't care to make too much about the acceptance of the electric bass in jazz, because it's been kind of modest at best to this
to this day.
There's considerable resistance remaining. But my personal experience was the people I most wanted to play with were, for the most part, interested in playing with me, and not so much in what it was I was wiggling my fingers upon, you know.
Well, you had a unique sound you developed. I mean, you didn't just pick up the bass. You created a jazz sound on the bass that was
that's exactly
revolutionary.
The point. Yeah.
Now, I don't want to get into the details of bass and strings and all that stuff, but you have a five string with a higher string, right? Not a lower one.
Yes, that's correct.
And to me, when you're in the upper register, it's so mellow. It sounds like a guitar, you know. It's so melodic and legato, I guess. I don't know. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. Sure. And I've spent a lot of time and money on my sound.
Yeah.
I've tended to focus on it more than on velocity. And in terms of my technical interests, and I found myself having to look for a sound, an unusual sound on the electric bass, just to make it fit within the music that I wanted to play. When I discovered the electric bass, or I think more to the point, when the electric bass discovered me, I was deeply committed to jazz music, the jazz tradition, and the evolution of that tradition. And when I was struck by the electric bass, that didn't change in the least. That was still my focus and my passion, and my life's work was within jazz. So I realized that I would have to look for a sound that worked well, and that had a lot to do with blending with the sound of drums as they were played by jazz drummers.
Well, I want to talk about that, but I don't want to dominate the conversation. Adam, you want to jump in?
Well, you know, I just knew that once we got things going, they would start to naturally evolve as far as what's going on. Because, you know, in my mind, you know, I know that, you know, Swallow, I always say, well, he's got that beautiful lyricism, and having that high string allows him to sing so beautifully. And right. I would used to give him tactics, and I'd say, oh, you're playing bebop.
I consider that a high compliment.
Well, you are worthy of such, my dear friend Swallow. And I just know that we are a product of everything that has affected us. And I know, you know, you would always mention the people that you loved when you were coming up, and people that impacted you with your development, people like Percy Heath and Wilbur Ware. So, you know, this is part of the sound that was in your body and in your soul. And you were trying to, you know, that's the sound you're hearing, even though you were playing an electric instrument. And yeah, exactly. this is part of what shapes are the way that we present our sound and what we do. And then I also know that through the experiences, excuse me, that you had playing with Jim Hall and things like that, somebody who was such a master storyteller, you were able to absorb a lot of that, you know, just profound lyricism and quality of content. You know, content, you know, what the story you're telling, not velocity, not shred, but really singing a song and singing something that has musical melodic value. And I know that, you know, I always hear just this beautiful song singing from you when it's time to solo. But the thing that what I love, and for me, which is crucial for me with any great bass player, the solos are the frosting on the cake. I really could care less if when I'm playing with a bass player, if he can take a solo or not. I want to feel that ickety boom with the spittle a ding. And for me, I mean, I can't say enough about the gratitude I have for Steve Swallow, because I got to play with him when I was 24 years old. And there's nothing better for a young drummer than to play with a bass player who has the experience and just the time with the time. And I think the same holds true vice versa. The best thing for a young bass player is to play with an experienced drummer, because it's that whole thing. You know, drummers don't play with drummers. Bass players don't play with bass players. The whole thing is getting that team to find kumbaya, you know, the ickety boom, the spittle a ding, and to find that together. And so for me, there's no words that can express my gratitude for Mr. Swallow here on so many levels.
Well, Steve. Thank you, Bob. But you have to realize that it was a symbiotic relationship that we had on the bandstand, and I was getting as much as you were getting. And that's an essential point about drummers and bass players. They're tied together. Their destinies are bound to each to the other. It's a very personal, very intimate thing that happens, that needs to happen between bass players and drummers.
Because, you know, a band is built from the bottom up. You know, some people think it's from the top down.
Not at all.
No. You don't start with the wallpaper and then put the foundation in the house, you know?
They need us, Bob.
To focus it back to drums, you mentioned you developed a sound that worked in that sound palette that used to be or exclusively the domain of the contrabass. That's a different thing than drummers having to change their sound to accommodate the electric bass, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think drummers did, in fact, change their sound to accommodate the electric bass. And you'd have to look to pioneers like Ben Benjamin and Al Jackson to research that stuff. There's very definitely a drum sound, and even more specifically a recorded drum sound, that is in substantial measure a response to the sound of the electric bass. But that's not the area in which I was choosing to work as well. The drummers I love to play with are jazz drummers, and that implies a certain touch and a certain use of the resources of the drum set.
What do you feel you need from drummers?
I think Adam started talking about it. The primary thing beyond any doubt whatsoever is the groove. The groove is what we're living to generate, and it's the groove we're heading towards, because it's so much fun when you get there. It's an irresistible force, not only to the listener, but to the player. It feels so good when the groove is happening. Then that's overwhelmingly the most important aspect of drumming from my perspective on the bandstand. And it's a sort of thing that's that's endangered as a point of view, I think, within the educational establishment. Of necessity, if you're sitting for your private lesson with your drum teacher in a room, you're not focusing on playing a groove with a bass player. You're focusing on aspects of technique or playing a nice groove all by oneself. But that's only the very beginning of the story of what's really going on. What's really going on is a deep connection between the bass player and the drummer, who are making thousands of decisions every second about
Exactly, yeah.
where to put it and how to put it. In the bass player's case, how to articulate the time, and in addition to where each quarter note is supposed to go.
You know, when I was in my 20s, I took we called it a music lesson. I took a lesson with John Clayton, the great bass player, because of exactly what you're talking about. I
That
wanted.
was a smart thing to do.
Yeah, I wonder if more drummers have considered, calling up their favorite bass players and paying them for a lesson if that's what it takes, and working with a bass player instead of, alone in a studio like that.
I think that's a wonderful idea, and by extension too. I think it's incumbent on the schools to include that option in their curriculum. That bass players and drummers can routinely get together with their elders and their peers and play together. It's a glaring omission in the what's taught
Right.
in most schools, I think.
Now, you taught at Berkeley in the early years, right? A couple of years there.
Mid-70s for a couple of years, I did teach there, and that was at a time when there was still a heavy emphasis on the acoustic bass. John Neves was the principal bass teacher at that time, a wonderful acoustic bass player. And I was sort of the new guy on electric, but there, within a very few years, the tables had turned, and they've never turned back.
Are you a proponent of jazz education?
Yes, of course, I really am. I'm also occasionally pretty critical of it because I see it as deficient in certain ways, and I'm also often insistent on that young people take a look at the things that can't be taught at school if they're interested in playing music. But that said, I think what's available in school in terms of learning your craft is invaluable and indispensable as well. It needs to be learned.
There's a PBS documentary from years ago on Louis Armstrong, and at one point they make the point that the ultimate to sum it up, the ultimate expression of technique is nuance. It's not velocity, it's not chops, it's the ability to express oneself.
That's very nice. That's very nicely put. Leave it to Louis Armstrong to say it all for all of us here.
Yeah, really. Now you're also a composer.
Yes.
Is that something you came naturally to you? Did you study composition? Did you how did you get involved as a writer?
Well, that's an interesting story. I did have a bit of schooling in music theory, but it wasn't specifically jazz theory at all. It was classical music studies, and they ended abruptly when I left university midway through my second year, in order to move to New York and play jazz. And my formal studies in composition ended at that time, but informally I kept learning to this day, hopefully. Well, I had written things as a student, and luckily I destroyed or lost them all, because they really were student pieces. They were student, they were exercises. And when I arrived in New York, I stopped composing to focus on learning to play the damn bass, because it was imperative that I learn as quickly as possible. And I'd gone for 3 or 4 years without thinking about writing music at all. I was in Berlin in, I guess, 1964, working with Art Farmer and Jim Hall, and the drummer in that band was Pete LaRocca. At that time, bass players and drummers roomed together. And I'm deeply grateful that was the case. That was a great part of my process of learning stuff from drummers. And Pete and I used to stay up late after the gig and talk about everything under the sun. And at one point, one early morning, he kind of brought me up straight and challenged me and said, "Look, you've been talking about writing music and about compositions in the repertoire very knowingly for weeks on end, but I don't see any tunes. Why don't you write something? Put your money where your mouth is, and all of that." And I took it to heart. He was absolutely right. I was just mouthing off about compositions. So I took him at his word, and the next afternoon I went to the club and used the club's piano and fished for a tune, and for a few days thereafter did that same process and came up with a tune that was okay. It was called Eiderdown, and it's often played to this day. So I did. Unfortunately, at the end of having written Eiderdown, I thought, "Well, this is pretty easy. There's nothing to this whatsoever." But I kind of lucked out. I brought the tune to Art Farmer and Jim Hall, and they liked it as well, and we began playing it. So there I was, from farm to table, but in no time at all. I said, "Oh, great." And then went to return to writing ever thereafter. And it's just plain miserable hard work. It's a very solitary activity. There's nothing social about it at all, and that's just dots on the page, and it's an infuriatingly slow work. At least it is for me, and I regret to this day that I got into it. But here I am, all these years down the road, still writing music. I must say, actually, that I'm very happily engaged in writing it these days, despite the misery it brings to you.
Well, now I've always heard that playing gets easier as you get older and writing gets harder. Would you disagree or agree with it?
I'd agree to a point. Playing for me, I think, continued to get easier until a while ago, when for circumstances, I wasn't able to play for 2 or 3 years, and since then I've found that it's harder than it used to be.
Really?
I think I'm in the process, a half year down the road, of still kind of climbing up on the horse, but it's there somewhere. But I would agree that writing music has gotten harder for me over the years. I think because I've gotten a lot pickier about the notes I'm choosing. I'm making it harder on myself.
More self-critical, yeah. Now you mentioned Pete. I know there are legions of drummers who have learned from you. Can you identify some drummers that you've learned from?
Well, yeah, Pete needs to be mentioned first, because he was there when I most needed a drummer, when I was desperately in need of somebody's hand to lead me further down the rhythm section path quickly. And he was there when I needed him, and he became my best friend and my inspiration and all of that in one portable package. We spent a lot of time on the road together, a lot of time sharing a hotel room together. So it was a very, very close relationship. And he had, as drummers know, a magnificent right hand, the most beautiful, beautiful right hand. He used plastic tip sticks, unlike almost anybody else who looked down on them with contempt. You know, he loved the definition in the attack that the plastic tip sticks gave him on his beautiful A. Zildjian ride cymbal.
And yeah, I was going to say it helped define the ride cymbal sound. With a little more, just a little more ping, a little more attack.
He was very deliberate and very careful about his sound, and regardless of the context he was playing with. I went from Pete pretty much directly to Roy Haynes, and one could do worse. And played with Roy for a long time, for about 5 years all told. And again, I can't overstate his importance to what I know about the flow of rhythm. To mention one of the aspects of his teaching, drummers are very much contrary to their image. In my mind, kind of the intellectuals of the band, the mathematicians of the band. Mm-hmm. And so what I was learning was not altogether something intangible, that the sort of mystical aspects of being in the flow and nailing the groove and all of that. I was learning how mathematics and music are so closely intertwined, and I was learning that principally from a succession of drummers. I mean, Pete and Roy Haynes were the guys I was spending most of the time working with, but I was also playing with Danny Richmond, I don't know, a host of other really remarkable drummers, and trying to suck whatever I could from each of them that I played with.
That's great insight.
I could go on the list. I kind of define my progress as a bass player in terms of the drummer I was playing with at the time.
Interesting.
The one I've been touching on, Pete and Roy, all happened in the 1960s, and the 70s were a whole nother kettle of fish. And then Adam happened in the 1980s, and we had several remarkable years, and we're still
at hooked it. Up.
Once at it, always at it. Yeah.
And you also worked with some incredible band leaders. First of all, my condolences on the loss of your life partner, Carla Bley.
Thanks.
Very recently. And I can only imagine. Anyway, my condolences.
Talk about remarkable band leaders as well. Yeah. She was a permissive parent as well as my best friend.
Well, my sincere condolences. So let's talk about some of the other band leaders you've worked with. Adam, you know him better than me, but I'll just throw out some names. Gary Burton, Bill Evans, Chick Corea, Stan Getz, Pat Metheny, John Scofield, to name a couple.
There's a few, yeah.
There's a few there. Tell me about Bill Evans.
Well, we've spent a certain amount of time already talking about nuance and generating a beautiful sound and all of that stuff. And of course, Bill is at the forefront of that kind of technique. his ability to draw sound out of the piano was thoroughly remarkable, and was recognized not only by the jazz community but by the so-called the community of so-called classical pianists as well. Many of them were as astonished and mystified by his ability to make the piano sing as I was. He was also a master harmonist. Sometimes it was as few as one or two chords in the standard harmonization of a Tin Pan Alley classic tune that would just bring that tune to life. He would just find something that would pull it into his idiom so thoroughly that the tune became in effect his. And, one identifies certain tunes, or at least I do, and I know Adam does too. You identify certain tunes with certain people and singers in particular. There are certain things that Billie Holiday just owns and always will. That's less true of instrumentalists, but it's true of Bill Evans. There are a bunch of tunes I wouldn't think of playing without him. He's just, his stamp on those tunes is so indelible that they're his, as well as the Tin Pan Alley composer who wrote them in the first place. Hello, Cosmo.
It's Cosmo. Cosmo's the steals the show every time.
No doubt.
Adam, you want to ask him about some more other leaders, Ernie?
Well, you know what I was always curious about? I know that basically Stan's rhythm section was Gary, you, Roy, and you.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is then Gary's first band was the same band with Coryell.
Right.
talk about shifting the whole paradigm. You know, here you got, you know, Stan, who we could all agree was probably one of the greatest natural musicians.
Absolutely. This is Stan Getz, by the way, for people who may
Stan
not know.
Getz, right. I mean, you know, this is somebody who just, he could hear, you know, he had ears like Dumbo. You know, time, sound, just one of those freaks.
Yep.
And then, so what precipitated, you know, Gary? I'm just wondering how it went from you guys splitting as a unit. Did Stan break up the band, or did Gary go, I think it's time that we do something different, Swallow? I mean, I'm just wondering how this all, you know, morphed, because then bringing in Coryell, who was also somebody who, you know, straddled the two worlds, you know, the jazz and the rock thing. And, you know, you could call him one of the early guys of that term. I don't like fusion, but.
Yeah, he was. He brought that to the band. We were willing victims, but he brought it. And that's an important thing he did, I think. It was the influences he exposed me to and kind of pushed onto the bandstand as well.
Right. Well, I'm just curious, did Stan break up the band, or did Gary, you know, how did that all kind of
morph? It happened over time, and it is a kind of long and complicated story, but essentially Gary stormed out of the band. He'd finally just had it with Stan's nonsense, and Stan could be as nonsensical as he was the sublime melodist of all time. He was also
a nice bunch of guys.
He was a nice bunch of guys. At any rate, Gary had it one night after the gig, and just simply stormed away from the band. And he and I had been discussing leaving and discussing forming Gary's band for some time, but his His leaving Stan was sudden and unexpected. And I remained with Roy and got Chick Corea onto the band. So Stan's rhythm section became Roy and Chick and I. I continued talking a lot, almost daily, with Gary about plans to get his band going, and only spent another 6 or 8 months with Stan myself, and then left, and I forget who the bass player was. It might even have been Dave Holland, who joined Stan's band in my place, but Roy stayed with the band, and Chick did too for some time. And then finally Roy left in order to join Gary's band as well, and it was made in heaven. We had a great time. Three of us, Gary Burton, Roy Haynes, and I, ended up on the same bandstand under Gary's name, and Gary brought in Larry Coryell. As you were just saying, Roy was kind of in and out, and his replacement was Bob Moses. Bob Moses came and sat in at the Cafe Agogo, a coffee place up at Regis. We were using as a kind of laboratory to put our music together. We played there for weeks on end, which was another part of the miracle that was New York City in those days. One could do that, you know. At any rate, yeah, I remember Bob Moses sitting in with the band for the first time, and again there was that same instant connection between drums and bass. I felt really comfortable with Bob's playing, which is saying a lot because he had taken the drums over from Roy Haynes, who kind of defines the bebop tradition to my way of thinking to this day. Moses came in for a while and then he left and Roy returned, and then Roy left again and Moses returned, and so on. The drum chair was fluent for a time there, but it was always in good hands.
I have no doubts. I used to kid Moses, you know, he grew up as, you know, in the same building as Art Blakey, Max Roach, and Elvin Jones. Okay. It's like if he couldn't play, you know.
That's something from osmosis alone, yeah.
Something in that building.
Something pretty about amazing. That building, indeed.
Must be in the water.
Elmo Hope lived there for a time, too. It wasn't all drummers.
Right, Joseph Papp.
Ah, yes.
There's a plaque on that building, 415 Central Park West. Yeah. I used to drive by there all the time just to see, you know, if somebody would be coming out. I remember bringing Elvin home from the Vanguard one night when he had bought us all drinks and didn't have money for the cab. So I drove him home.
That's
the least I could do.
Well,
I doubt that Bob Moses' name is on that plaque, and it should be, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But that's, you know, I was just curious. And there's also that great recording where, you know, the outtakes of the Sweet Rain session.
I have heard those, yeah.
Yeah, where it was Stan Getz's session with Chick, and the record had Ron and Grady Tate on it, but the band was actually Swallow and Roy. But Stan was having a rough day that day. And it's fascinating to hear how on fire you guys are on that. You know, Stan, he's slipping and sliding a little bit, but you cats, it's fantastic. And I'm glad that's kind of serviced. And it's also wonderful to hear when the heroes are not able to hit a home run every time.
Right, that is reassuring, and it's certainly the truth too. That's certainly in my experience. That my heroes are. I think one of the things I love about my heroes, and I that's more important to me than respect, I think, is that they're all guys who are willing to fall on their faces now and then. The willingness to fall on your face opens up a broad range of activities you're otherwise kind of holding yourself back from.
Takes a courage.
Surrender, surrender, the courage to sur you know, I love that they went after Miles passed away, they started to release all these alternate takes and everything, and they released a box set of the Freedom Jazz Dance sessions. And you hear basically the studio log of Miles, and Miles is trying to play Freedom Jazz Dance, and
So
it's a
maybe on a Sunday,
saxophone.
is that
Yeah,
correct?
and he's going to Tio. Tio, I can't play this. And you hear Tio going, "Of course you can, Miles. Of course you can." He goes, "Well, Tio, maybe on a Sunday." I mean, and you hear how they figure it out, and you it's just not instant magic. These are human beings, and
Yes.
it's nice to hear even when your heroes are having a rough time,
I like baseball analogies because if you hit 300, man, you're playing in Yankee Stadium, but you're still out 70% of the time.
That's right. It's
Hall
just
of
a
Fame
kind
memory.
of
Let's say
hard
you hit
to
400. Now you're in the Hall of Fame,
hit
man. You're still out most of the time. You have
that.
to come to terms with your humanity in there, no matter who you are.
Yeah.
So how did you and Mr. Nussbaum hook up?
We hooked up through John Scofield during the time I taught in Boston at Berkeley in the mid 1970s. John had just finished up as a student there, and was kind of hanging around town before he made the move to New York. He was kind of dithering in Boston, waiting for the right gig to come along and for the moment to come when he packed everything up and moved to New York. And in the course of our crossing paths in Boston, I played with him a couple of times, and again, immediate connection and a kind of surety on my part that John and I would be playing together again. And then in by 1980, I believe it was, and Adam's the chronicler of all this stuff. In 1980, John called and said, "I want to have a trio, and I've got this drummer I think you'll like. What do you think?" And I said, "Fine." And showed up, I guess, at the basement of Westbeth. Is that right, Adam? And Westbeth was and still is a wonderful subsidized artist's housing
Oh,
building
yeah, I know about that
in
place.
lower Manhattan, and it's been the scene of a lot of great unrecorded music, including our first rehearsal. It felt great right away, and we embarked upon having a trio together, and did some wonderful tours and some remarkable records as well, I think.
You guys are great at that.
I've played with Adam since in a variety of contexts, all kinds of one of which you mentioned, the Damaged in Transit with Chris Potter. That's the trio one with Chris Potter, if I'm
With
not
Chris Potter, right?
mistaken.
Yeah. Wonderful album.
It was
And universally
wonderful.
acclaimed as a masterpiece.
And more to the point, a lot of fun. The great thing about live albums is the mood is often a bit lighter than the mood in a studio album, where everybody's furrowing his brows and hoping not to make even a small mistake,
Let's talk about that live element of making music together in the moment, which is the core of jazz music to me, as opposed to being in the studio for 18 months, 2 years to produce an album. I've never understood
We've
that.
never had that luxury. Usually it's like, if we're lucky, it's a few days. It's not like take a week on a bass drum sound and 2 weeks. I've so many dates we do. You go in, it's a picture of a moment. Okay, you got 4 hours, or maybe you've got 2 days, and you're going to come up with an hour of music. That's it. Thank you. Good night, Irene. We don't have that luxury. And because we're also playing in real time,
Right.
generally.
Right.
We're not phoning in parts where everything is being layered. Basically, when we go into the studio, it's almost like we are playing live, but within that surgical environment as such. Mm-hmm. If you want to call it that.
And on a good day, that's a nice thing to kind of have the beautiful crystalline sound you can get in a studio context, and to have everybody focused as hard as can be focused on the objective to get good takes of all of these songs. It can be a very positive environment. I don't mean to paint it as the villain, but there is some, as Adam said, it's when you're playing jazz, there's deconstructed, sure enough.
Now this one, I think we were really, this was ideal because we had been on the road for about 3 weeks. We all came home, we had a day off, and then we went into the studio.
Right. And that was
so we were all like, everything was well greased up, mm-hmm. nice and sharp, and we'd been hitting it. So then we just went to the studio, and it was ideal. Many times you do the record first, and then you go out on the road.
And that's something that's most often dictated by business considerations, and it's an unfortunate
example. This was a good one. This was a good one because we'd had that. And yeah, I mean, there's no substitute with the intimacy that occurs playing on a nightly basis. And there's no substitute for that. And that, to me, is one of the things that I'm just sad seeing on the scene. There used to be a circuit. You know, you think of when you were out on the road, Swallow, you could go cross country working a week here, 2 weeks there. Going across the country, all the records of all the bands we love from the late 50s, 60s, they were working 40 weeks, 50 weeks a year, six nights a week. You can't practice that.
And each night was four or five sets, too.
Right.
Nine to three.
So, I mean, to me, there's no better platform than that. And the sadness for me is that it's not existing anymore. And I don't know what it's going to be for the next generation, but it's like, ba-do-ba-do-boo-boo-bee-da. Things ain't what they used to be. And they got to do something if they want to be able to propagate that level of mastery and the cohesion and intimacy that happens with music. It's not like, oh yeah, babe, I have 1,000 first dates. I love everyone. Come on, give me a break, you know? It's not like that. You want to be able to get in there and have that time to develop that. And I think it comes from a trust factor that comes over time. And once you trust people, then you can start really getting down in there.
That's absolutely true between drummers and bass players. There has to be a level of trust, and that level can only be built through experience, through playing together again and again.
Yeah, you can't learn experience. It has to just come from doing it, you know? Yeah.
It's harder and harder to do these days, though, too, to find the venues.
That's the conundrum right now, because there's more and more coming out of schools, and there's less places within the community.
Yeah, that circuit that existed, that circuit of clubs you could plug into and really apprentice your craft. They ceased to exist really in the late 1960s, and what really splintered apart was. Not just the just musical elements, the community elements fractured. In particular, I was playing a lot of clubs within the Black community. There was a substantial Black audience for jazz music in the 19 60s, and the riots of the late 1960s effectively brought the community that existed to a halt. It kind of fractured it, and there was also a white audience for the music that also kind of took it on the chin during the 70s, 80s, and subsequently as well. So when you look toward the dissolution of that circuit of gigs that allowed bass players and drummers to really get to know each other, you've got to look well beyond music for the answers to why and for the reasons for all of them.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Fascinating conversation. I don't want to keep you too long.
You could be here forever.
I was going to say, I don't want to keep you too long. You've been very generous with your time.
But they're important, you know? I mean, it's a kind of sociology that brought Adam and I from our very disparate childhoods, to not that disparate, but somewhat, together on the bandstand night after night. And how do you end up playing with a guy from Germany for weeks on end, and then there's a guy from Portugal you've come to love to play with, and all of this stuff. All of that is fascinating, and it's germane to the central thing we're talking about, that hookup that happens between bass and drums.
Well, I think we've covered it, gentlemen. Anything else you want to throw in before I put a wrap on it?
Well, we could go all day, and this could be a part one of a lot of fun, but I think this has at least been a wonderful opportunity to bring my dearest friend, the good citizen Swallow, out and about into the digital world here. And I hope that people will be able to just come in and listen and get a little taste of something I've been so fortunate to savor.
Adam, thanks a lot. Thanks for your hand in bringing this together. And thanks, Michael, very much. I much enjoyed this, and it was a pleasure to think about these things with you.
Well, I can't thank you enough. As I said, you are a legend, and we certainly appreciate all of your insight, especially taking the time to talk about drummers with a couple of drummers. And a lot more who will be watching.
That's my idea of heaven, a little time with a couple of drummers. What more could you ask for? I'm grateful for the chance to talk about this stuff. Thanks, Michael.
Well, you're welcome back anytime. And I think you've opened a new can of worms for us with talking to bass players. That's a great idea, Adam.
I think you should. And we belong together, you know. Adam, nice to see your face, man.
One of my treasures, Steve. You are one of my treasures, and I can't express in words how much I love you.
Yeah, likewise. Well, keep your sword sharp. That's it. Thank you very much.
Well, you're my new friend, Steve, and I sure appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. I enjoyed it a lot.